Good morning, everyone. We are broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. I'm Georgia.
And I'm Hannah.
And you're listening to Film Picnic. We would like to start the show by acknowledging that Film Picnic is recorded on the ancestral lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. This land was not given up freely, which is why we refer to it as unceded territory, and continues to be home for the Indigenous communities from which it is stolen.
Yes, it is with immense privilege that we talk into these microphones and share our stories as stories have been shared for generations before us on this land. We hope that Film Picnic can be a space for shared accountability, knowledge sharing, and reconciliation. This always was and always will be Indigenous land. And on that note, I also think it's important to note that the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation is coming up next Monday on September 30th. Georgia and I will be attending an in-person event on campus. And if you're looking for other ways to engage with the holiday,
a great place to start is by viewing some Indigenous cinema. In the episode description for today, we've included a link for Alanis Abomswain's 1993 documentary, Kanisatake, 270 Years of Resistance. Abomswain is an Abenaki American-Canadian filmmaker, singer, artist, and activist, primarily known for her documentary films. Really just one of the most acclaimed Indigenous directors in the world, which is really amazing. And I highly recommend checking out anything that she's done. Coincidentally, she's also going to be at VIFF this year, the Vancouver International Film Festival. She's giving a talk on October 5th. I'll be there.
Georgia will be there. Highly recommend.
I don't know if the tickets have sold out yet, but stay tuned. Take a look. We'll put that link in the description as well. To introduce the lovely person in the studio with us today, joining us live as our first on-air guest, Vancouver-based academic, film philosopher, author, educator, festival executive, filmmaker, known for her work in cinema and media studies. She explores topics of transnational Asian cinemas, gender, sexuality, race, and ethnicity. Ladies, gentlemen, noble folk of all sorts, please welcome Mila Suo.
Hi, it's such a pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. At 10 a.m. on a Friday.
It's a sunny morning. I'm happy it's been a sunny morning today.
Yeah.
I feel like I needed a little sun. Mm-hmm. I picked up Hannah on the way here, and it was
beautiful.
We were enjoying
listening to some great music.
Listening to some great music in the car on the way in. We just love to dive in a little bit to your background, if that's okay. Hannah and I have both met. For context, Hannah and I have both met Mila as a prof at UBC in the Department of Theater and Film.
Went to Portugal together.
Yes, yeah. Attended a global seminar, I got to have that really wonderful experience there. You joined the Department of Theater and Film. You've been in Vancouver for several years. We did a little research. Undergrad at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Worked at,
which is so cool.
So cool.
It radicalized me.
It did?
It's the beginning of my radicalization.
Wow. Yeah.
That's beautiful. You know what? I've heard that about Berkeley, to be honest.
Yeah, it has that reputation.
I've heard that about Berkeley. Mm-hmm. I had a middle school math teacher who was constantly trying to, this was in Oregon. This was in hippie town in Oregon. And my middle school math teacher was always trying to get us to consider UC Berkeley as a university option, even though we were in middle school.
Getting in early.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. We saw that you have spent some time working at SOMA magazine.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Was this in San Francisco?
It was, yeah.
Okay, beautiful.
My first real job.
Your first real job, was that in school or outside, just after school?
It was between my undergrad and my grad career. Okay. Yeah, okay. So I did a stint there. Wow, I'm surprised you announced that. Actually.
We have our sources. And then, moving further south in California, master's, postgraduate studies at UCLA, so the master's and PhD. And then something that Mila and I have in common, we both lived in Oregon, which is very cute, Oregon State University. And that was your, correct me if I'm wrong here, your first film professor. That was your first time being a prof of film studies.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Can I ask what you specifically did in your undergrad and then for your master's and PhD?
Sure. I double majored in film and English at Berkeley.
Yep.
And then for graduate school, it was cinema and media studies in the department of, I think it's called, what is it called? Television, theater, television, and film, I think, at UCLA.
Nice. Yeah. And then a PhD.
Also, yes, in cinema and media studies. I just kept going.
Wow. How long did it? I know everybody has a different length of time for PhDs. How long did your PhD take you?
Yeah, so my PhD took about 6 years, which is slightly longer than the Canadian PhDs, from my understanding. I think we try to kind of usher people out within 4 to 5 years here, but I don't know how folks do it, honestly. I had to take the 6 years.
Yeah.
I did some field research in China, so it was... That took some time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We do have notes on your doctoral dissertation
here.
Oh, my
goodness. Wow.
I guess because Hannah and I are both from a background of just...
All over the place.
We've both moved a lot of times. And I feel like that's something that we kind of bonded over and have...
Yes.
We talked about a little bit in our first episode.
Yeah.
but I guess just in terms of geographic location in relation to... the film industry as a whole, because, you know, like we can see that there's kind of a motivation for moving based on academic context. But in terms of, because you're not just an academic, you're a filmmaker yourself. Have you found it's been, is there like one specific location that you've lived, do you think, where there's been more opportunities? Because you did spend time in LA, you're in Vancouver now, to just hubs. For production, like, was that
Hollywood North?
Hollywood North, yes. Was there like opportunities that were afforded to you because of where you were?
Oh, absolutely. I think living in LA, it being kind of this epicenter of film and TV in the US, you know, there's LA and there's New York. I've never had the privilege of living in New York. I've always wanted to, but because
don't we all?
Right?
Yeah.
So mythological. Because I was doing my grad studies there at UCLA, the first film that I made called Carnal Orient, I don't think it would have been possible to make a film like that if I were not in LA.
Why is that?
Oh, a lot of free and willing labor, on a student project, for example. You know, I got to hold auditions in West Hollywood. I had a wonderful producer who was a friend from Berkeley, Camille Mana, who's an actress and producer in Hollywood. And just by linking up with her, she was able to kind of help us navigate through all the kinds of, you know, like administrative things and just the kind of the things that one would do to like set up auditions and sign various forms and paperwork that's needed. But yeah, held auditions. Actors came on for free, basically, which I think is a little bit shady nowadays. But this was a Kickstarter film I was making. And...
I mean, if you're all students, that's kind of the way it goes.
Right, you guys understand.
Yes.
Yeah.
I myself have, well, just because being film studies, like, there's not been, I'm in a film production class now, but it's just an elective, but it's been so far, if I want to be on sets, it's all very, like, voluntary, and I've been a PA, we've been, like, doing the hustling thing, where you're just, it is free labor, but.
Would you say, then, that your network, or, like, a network was more accessible in spaces like LA?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many people there who are so keen and passionate and just willing to dive into anything. I mean, Carnal Orient's very experimental. It's, you know, it's an experimental horror film with no dialogue. There's only one song. And so to get people on board with that, it didn't take a lot of convincing. It just was like, we're doing this, and people were on board. So I think just that aspect of it was really, really helpful, just to be around other film lovers, right? I think in Vancouver as well, I feel still like I'm a bit of a stranger to this particular scene. I've been here for 5 years, but I've had a kid. I've been like working and writing a book. So I haven't been able to get plugged into the scene here as much, but I'm sure as you know, yeah, Hollywood North, there's lots of opportunities.
There's stuff going on. There are lots of opportunities, but also a lot of the opportunities are coming from the actual Hollywood.
From LA.
Like a lot of, you know, the stuff that is shooting here is coming from the U.S. Mm. But
I think, also people that Han and I were lucky enough to go to a panel at the Vancouver Queer Film Festival. And some of the, I think there were four panelists and all of them were to some degree between Vancouver and L.A. Or at least talked about going between. But there was one person who mentioned
Manitoba.
That there was a big, I think Winnipeg.
Oh,
they talked
yeah.
about being in Winnipeg and how they kept getting brought back there for film projects. So then it was like they decided to move there and then that's become where they are. So I don't know. I think it's we're just curious about
different communities and like different spaces, especially
where is the opportunity or can it be created anywhere?
Yeah,
are all places created equal?
Oh,
I think you can. There's going to be film communities, film lovers, cinephiles anywhere you go.
Yeah.
So really, you can.
Me personally, I'm from all my family is back in Australia, so I've always heard that the film industry doesn't exist there and blah 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 blah. But the more that I'm you know, asking around and like looking into it, there are actually a lot of really awesome, maybe not Hollywood level projects, but there are a lot of really cool stuff happening back home in Australia. It's just far away. It's just far away from a lot of other countries. And I think that's the hard part about the industry there. But
I mean, I will say, I went and saw The Fall Guy in theaters just to talk about, we're going to talk about a Hollywood blockbuster and immediately, exposing Hannah, except she already disclosed this last episode. But Hannah lived in Sydney.
I did live
and,
in Sydney.
And such a large part of exposed. The Fall Guy was not exposed. Such a large part of that was filmed in front of the Opera House. So then as immediately when I came home from the theater, I was like, Hannah, guess what I saw?
I always love when things are shot in Sydney. I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
I used to hang out there.
Quickly, on the topic of living somewhere where something has been shot.
Mm.
A quick plug for The Shining, not that it needs any more plugs, but I used to live in 45 minutes away from the town where the exterior shots of the hotel were shot.
Wow.
It's Timberline Lodge on Mount Hood, Oregon, and I used to live in Hood River, and I watched The Shining, and it's great because it's great, and Jack Nicholson is great, and Shelley Duvall is great, but it's also great because I watch it, and it's like, oh, it's a little piece of home.
Home.
Yeah.
You watch The Shining and think home.
And what about it? And what about it?
Nothing.
Continuing on.
So you are an academic and a filmmaker. Do you feel like, do you see yourself as more of one or the other? Does that blend? Does that change between contexts?
Yeah, that's a great question. At this point, I feel like it's very symbiotic. I feel like, but it is about what gear I'm in. I definitely am switching gears from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm, you know, expected to do here as a professor in my day job is more traditional scholarship. So it's writing books and articles.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I'm just not fully satisfied with just doing that. I feel like I have this creative itch that needs, I need a creative outlet to get out various kinds of things, anger, feelings, opinions, whatever.
Yeah. And film is a great medium.
And film is a great medium for that. My dad is an artist, so I think maybe growing up with that was an influence on me. So, I think it's just about switching gears. Like right now, I've just, you know, written a chapter for a book on Chinese American cinemas about a Chinese filmmaker named, Taiwanese filmmaker named Patrick Wang. I don't know if either of you know him.
That name is very familiar to me.
His works, his films are amazing.
Yeah.
They're really kind of undervalued, underestimated, but they're incredible kind of masterpieces. He's kind of like an Edward Yang type for independent American cinema. But so I've just written that. I've just been in a bubble of writing.
Mm.
And then, but I have a grant. I'm very lucky to have a Shirk Fellowship for an experimental documentary that I'm working on now called Mongoloids. So I'm about to shift gears.
Exciting.
Into that.
Okay.
Yeah, congratulations on the grad.
We'll be asking you about that.
Yeah, we have questions.
You'll have a chance to promote.
Well, I mean, being a professor, that's like a lot and can be all-encompassing. I'm wondering how you decide to take on projects throughout the academic year or like how they come to you. And yeah.
Yeah, I am someone who's lately been just responding to invitations. Mm. So like this chapter, for instance, is someone who approached me, hey, do you want to write for this anthology for, you know, Oxford University Press? Sure, because it's someone I know and someone who I'm friends with who's editing it. When I, let's say, jury for various festivals is by invitation, I find it very hard to decline.
Yes.
Because I love watching films and just being able to see festival films is such a privilege. And
I saw you're on the jury for VIFF this year.
Yeah, I am.
That's exciting.
I want to have that conversation on Monday.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Exciting. I was lucky enough to go to VIFF last night. I was just telling Mila in the lobby outside. I went to VIFF last night and saw her in the program. Her picture's in there. She's famous. To bring our conversation from outside inside, Mila, if you don't mind, we were just discussing really briefly, like, how festivals are a wonderful way to engage with world cinema and kind of create an appetite for something that is not blockbusters necessarily. Because, yeah, know and love blockbusters. But would you say there's a film that you saw at a festival that maybe was like pivotal for you or something? Like, is there a world film that you think really changed your personal tastes towards maybe festival films or world cinema?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure when my sort of appetite for festival films came about. I mean, I think probably during grad school at UCLA, there were so many great kind of retrospectives happening there for, you know, like the Hammer Museum would have something on Chinese or Taiwanese cinema, and that I really, that really appealed to me. I think I mentioned Edward Yang in this conversation, but, you know, the Hou Hsiao-hsien, Edward Yang, I think there was probably like some retrospective of Taiwanese cinema that was very interesting to me. But I think even before that, though, when I was growing up, just watching like fifth generation Chinese cinemas, and I'm not sure how it just kind of entered into my world, I think, being, you know, growing up in the Midwest in the U.S. as a diasporic Chinese, you know, first generation person. I think I just was like very much wanted to understand where I'd come from. And so I think I sought a lot of that on my own somehow, right?
Yeah.
Like I kind of just cobbled together a kind of world cinema education for myself, just as a teenager, just being bored, probably asking my parents who, you know, what kind of films they had seen, and learning about like Zhang Yimou, all the big names, and then that kind of dilates into this broader appetite for just world cinema, international cinemas. Seeing different perspectives, seeing how different people live around the world, right? Just following those curiosities and then 100%. Saying yes. Saying yes to all those opportunities then, right?
Yeah, I resonate with that a lot. I feel like I found a lot of connection in watching some films that weren't just shown to me on the TV or whatever. And I think that, like, the reason I went into film production was because I feel like film is one of the most digested forms of media, and it's also cinema as an empathy machine. Where did this come from? People say this all the time.
No, but this is great. I love this.
It's a great way to share a perspective and really like allow people to empathize with that perspective and understanding.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think ethically it's important too.
Yeah.
See 100%. How other people live.
Yeah.
See, yeah.
I think to some degree, even though I'm just, I feel like beginning my kind of foray into the world cinema. I was saying too, if it's, well, let's say we can disclose that Mila is the spouse of our faculty supervisor, Will Brown. And he, have you had him as a prof before?
I haven't. I will have him next semester, though.
Yeah. Okay, exciting. There we go. I was just saying, too, I think Will Brown's
class. Well, I have, actually.
You have.
For the Go Global program, yes.
Yeah, I think his, actually, where I first watched Kinesitake, 270 Years of Resistance, that was in his class on Canadian, it was supposed to be Canadian cinema, but he really made it Canadian Indigenous cinema. Mm-hmm. And that was just one of the first opportunities that I think I had. And that was only a year ago and something like that. But even though to some degree I feel like it can be annoying when someone gets really into something, for example, world cinema or festival film, and then immediately starts acting like an expert on it. I've also kind of shamelessly, I feel like I like to shamelessly promote, because I do think it's just such a great medium and so accessible and such a great way to learn about other parts of the world. I don't know. It's so interesting. It's such, film is such an interesting kind of way to take like a microscope into another culture almost, or just learn things that you never would have even known that you were missing.
That's been my
experience
I'm working at a documentary filmmaking company right now, and all of the projects are very ancestral based. And my boss, how she decides to take on a project is if it's going to have a positive impact, not just for like the audience, but for the filmmaker. If this is going to be an experience, is this going to reconnect in some way? And that has been so special. And documentary is different to narrative film, but just seeing the way that outside of actually just viewing the film, but the process of making a film can have an impact in a community has been really beautiful as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
On that note, we're going to take a quick little break, but we will be back in just about 2 minutes. So stay with us.
Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11 with your host John P for the best in post rock, drone, ambient, experimental, and noise. Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
And we are back. For those of you just tuning in, this is CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. This is Film Picnic. We have with us Mila Zuo. Going to continue on, just having a passionate conversation about film. Yeah. I think let's just start by saying, again, what I was saying outside, what an exciting time for festivals in Vancouver specifically.
September, October, I feel like, is when everything sort of kicks off.
So much is happening.
Yeah.
We have the International Film Festival kicked off yesterday, VIFF happening. Mm-hmm. The Vancouver Latin American Film Festival happened earlier this month. We had the Vancouver Queer Film Festival happening earlier this month. And then, Hannah, what else is happening this month?
Oh, funny you ask that, Georgia. Actually, this weekend, the Persistence of Vision Film Festival is happening, which I have, with my beautiful team, been festival coordinator this year. And that has been a really awesome experience. And yeah, that's happening here on UBC campus at the Freddie Wood Theater on Saturday the 28th and Sunday the 29th. And doors open at 6 p.m. So the first night will be 8 films, and the second night is 5 films with an award ceremony. And that's all of the student films that have come out of UBC from last year. So all of the third and fourth year films. Yeah.
That's great.
Let's highlight how important it is to support student work. Mm-hmm. I have been lucky enough to see some of these, coincidentally, because of
Georgia Swing Press.
I will be, yes. Film Picnic will be there doing some interviews, and that's going to be really great. But even one of the filmmakers was in the Portugal Go Global trip, and so got to see
Shout out
Josh. Yes, Chrome film will be at POV this weekend.
Also, two of the films that I produced, Noka and Sticks
yes,
of Our House.
Hannah, please, Hannah, multidisciplinary queen. Yeah, but that's going to be really great. And we encourage you all, those of you in Vancouver, to check it out because it's going
to
be.
Especially if you're at UBC and want to get involved in film. It's a great place to connect with.
Great place to meet people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Kind of staying on this festival trend and festival topic, we're lucky to have Mila with us today because she is a person that has extensive knowledge and experience working with festivals. You've had your own films. So you've been submitting as a filmmaker. You have been on juries. You've been on panels at festivals. And like we've mentioned, Hannah and I got to experience a festival with you, which was so exciting.
At different times, though, which was...
At different times, yes. But I guess just as kind of a general, how was your first foray into the festival world as a filmmaker, and then your kind of the other opportunities kind of blossomed from that, or like how did you initially get into it?
Yeah, that's exactly how it happened. I think with Carnal Orient in 2016, we submitted to a bunch of festivals, including Slam Dance, and we were very shocked that we actually got into that festival. So that was my very first experience going to Park City for the Slam Dance, Sundance kind of festival moment there. And then from that, you kind of, I don't know if it's specific to Slam Dance. I think it's actually once you are a filmmaker within a festival, I think they want to keep you in the family, so to speak. Like they, in some way, Slam Dance in particular is filmmakers programming other filmmakers' work. So that's one of their kind of ethos, right?
So, as opposed to non-filmmakers programming?
Yeah, as opposed to, yeah, exactly. So their programming teams are often people who have had films specifically in Slam Dance.
Okay.
Whether you're a producer or a writer, you can be anyone on a project that's played at Slam Dance, but their recruitment is that's how that particular festival recruits for programming. And so, yeah, they just ask, hey, do you want to start programming for us? And I think in 2020... maybe 2019 is when I started programming for them. In 2021, 2022, I became like a lead programmer for their first narratives section, which just means kind of chairing the discussion with the team of programmers for that. And then from there, it was... once you're kind of in that system, I don't know, like you meet other people and then they're like, hey, I also program for this or that. And then
one opportunity leads to the next.
It really does. Yeah. And then the juring thing as well. It's sort of like once you start, I don't know how folks find out, but they just do. And so last year I juried for Doxa and Mina and Close Up. And I even had to turn one down because I just didn't have the time. But which I'm so sad. Again, I hate like declining. I'm really bad at saying no, but especially for film
festivals. It's a lifelong.
It's a lifelong problem. Yeah. So basically exactly what you're saying, Georgia. I think it just sort of snowballs. Yeah.
I think that's great that Slam Dance does. That's really interesting that they use, that they invite the filmmakers who have already been involved with the festival.
Yeah. Can we, for those who may not know what Slam Dance is, Mila, would you describe it for us?
Yeah, I think Slam Dance sees itself as, it started as the festival that for folks who didn't get into Sundance. It saw itself as the punk cousin or the some kind of, you know, deviant relation to Sundance. It was for more edgier, I think this is how they might describe themselves, right? Like an edgier, more alternative space. Mm-hmm. As Sundance became kind of increasingly mainstream, right? So Slam Dance took place just down the street. They had a theater just down from where all the Sundance venues were.
And are they actually connected in terms of festivals, or is it kind of...
I don't think they're connected. They know of each other. They like there's a relationship.
But it's not like the same teams.
It's not the same team. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But there will be like third party panels where you either have a film at Slamdance or Sundance. And so I was on a panel with like Andrew Ahn 1 year with Carnal Orient, and he was at Sundance with his debut film Spa Night, and I was there with Carnal Orient. But we were on the same panel because it was an Asian American filmmakers focused panel.
Okay.
So there's a lot of kind of cross pollination, but that's technically separate.
Okay.
Are they happening at the same time?
Exact same time too.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
In kind of same area?
Exact same, on the same street in Park City.
That's nice.
Yeah. It's it's fun because you can hop back and forth.
Mm. Yeah. We were just kind of talking about having so many festivals going on at similar times,
like,
or same
times. What's the benefit versus,
or it's almost like you have to pick and choose. Yeah,
yeah.
You've got to like decide what you're going to see, which I think, mm-hmm. I mean, you get that even within one festival anyways. If it's a big enough festival, you know, multiple locations for screenings, you got to make choices about where you're going to go and what you're going to see and be strategic about it. I wanted to bring in a conversation that I heard you talk a little bit about it before we left for Portugal, but just generally the fact that it's not necessarily just the best film gets picked, and, you know, even if we would like it to be that way, or there's maybe intention for it to come across that way. I know I've heard you speak before a little bit about just maybe there being quotas, or the involvement of nepotism that happens in programming. And I was wondering if you could just kind of speak to maybe some of the difficulties that you've encountered in that realm. Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah. No, not at all. I think, and I've also written about this in a scholarly chapter, if anyone's interested in getting a little bit more of this piece of things, but it's
where might they find that?
Where did I write about it? I think I wrote it in a anthology called Anti-Feminisms in Media Culture, where I was talking about Kin and how Kin is really my latest film, I guess, is really grappling with the idea of feminism and white supremacy, for instance, and its role to play and women's role to play there. Anyway, but I do talk about the fact that Kin was part of the pandemic film festival. Like when it came out, it was part of these online festivals because everything was held online at that point. And then I did also talk about programming. Yes, programming and being the lead programmer for Slam Dance for those 2 years. And I'm taking a long break. I won't say I won't program again, but I'm just taking a very long break because of some of the frustrations that came out of that. So, you know, I don't want to air out too much dirty laundry, but it's that you're
whatever,
in a room.
Whatever you're comfortable with, yeah.
Yeah, you're in a Zoom room with, you know, let's say 12 to 20 other people from all around the world who ostensibly have a connection to, in this case, Slam Dance, and some who've been programming for many, many, many years, who get attached to a certain identity that Slam Dance has. They get attached to a certain way of running deliberations. This gets a little bit boring. It's just like bureaucratic stuff. But when I was the lead for the second year, I brought on board someone whose film I had helped program, who I thought was one of the most phenomenal first filmmakers I've ever seen. And his name is Skinner Myers. And he's a Black American filmmaker who's very much working in the traditions of kind of LA rebellion, right? Mm-hmm. He really kind of like radical, sometimes aggressive, quite formally experimental style. And so the film that his first film is called The Sleeping Negro, and it's absolutely astonishing. And when I was programming, I was like, this film has to be in the festival. Otherwise, I quit. I don't know what kind of ultimatum I could have made at that point.
So there's some of your personal taste.
So yes, your personal taste. You're basically arguing for and fighting for these films that you want to make it into a slate of like 10 films, let's say,
right,
out of thousands.
Narrowing
it down.
We have
4,000 something submissions.
Wow.
And we're expected to watch all of them.
Are there assistants or other people that are also watching things and giving you summaries, or is it all
no,
you?
No, no. The programming team does it for per category. And I should say 4,000 submissions, I think, overall for the festival. For first features specifically, I don't know the number, but it was, I had seen probably a couple hundred.
Wow.
Feature films.
What's the time frame in which you have to digest all of that information?
You have from, I think, when did submissions open? Like maybe September or August until, no, I don't know. I don't know. I'm really bad with
months.
Temporality.
That's okay.
You have months.
Okay.
Let's say you have about 6 months.
Okay.
That feels about right.
Yeah.
So it's not a week of being awake the entire time and watching all those
No,
films.
But towards the end, people are really having to do that. People are like cramming in those films.
Because is it then like sometimes people will submit later and then you have to watch the film later? Or is it just by the deadline from that point?
There are late submissions. Okay. There's rolling submissions.
Yeah.
So you have to stay on track of it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so that's why, like, one, it's so laborious. It's really time consuming. That's why. This is the first reason why I don't have the capacity for that level of programming. At this point. But so, okay. So I bring Skinner with me as co-captains.
Okay.
For one particular year. And it was just the most, I think it was the first, I don't know if I want to go on record saying it, but it might have been the first time people of color were lead programmers in this particular category.
Mm. At Slam Dance.
At Slam Dance. Mm. From my observation, it is majority white.
As are many.
Yeah, and that plays a huge role in the kinds of tastes that you are going to be managing, reckoning with, grappling with. And so there was so much pushback against how Skinner and I wanted to run the liberations and how we wanted to rank and everything. Like, we had somebody drop out, even.
Wow. A programmer,
and he was like, I'm a long-standing programmer for Slam Dance, and I just can't believe that they're doing, and it was like,
he made his dissent known.
Yes. And personally, I think that it was a kind of racialized reaction to Skinner and I doing this. And we had long conversations with the guy that runs Slam, who founded Slam Dance.
Yeah.
He's very cool. I think he's a great guy, Peter Baxter. He's like, his mission, everything was so cool from the very get-go for Slam Dance. But it had gotten to a point where these programmers are staying in, and they've been doing it for maybe even like a decade, and they have, again, they have an attachment to the way things are done. Mm-hmm. And when you're arguing about tastes and opinions, personal opinions, it's very hard to convince people, right?
Yeah.
And we struggle. So what we found was that by the end of deliberations, a lot of the films that got in are just the ones that people didn't feel passionately about either way.
It was kind of like more of the
middle
neutral.
Of the road gets in, because people are just tired of fighting at that point.
Yeah.
We've been on Zoom for hours at this point, right? So it's just like, fine, you know, I don't really want to have, I don't want to die on this battlefield or whatever, right? Like, it's so exhausting and takes a lot out of you. But then you just, sometimes you really want to put your foot down. Like, there was a film that got in that same year that Skinner's film got in. And again, I don't want to throw anyone under the bus or be whatever, but the film was by these two white male filmmakers from Brixton. The film is called The Brixton's Tale. And it tried to show, tried to represent the black community in Brixton in a way that I thought was just incredibly problematic, to say the least. Two white filmmakers, and there's so much just racist tropes.
I can imagine stereotypes and prejudice.
Yeah, about
biases,
this particular, right. The criminality of this, like, black man, it was so incredibly racist that I and basically that year I couldn't make the final deliberations. I sent in my notes. I said The Sleeping Negro is absolutely my top film and it has to be in this festival. Please do not program A Brixton Tale. And I know this is not good form to talk, but as a scholar, I think that, you know, we do critique films a lot. So I think that, and particularly when we find it quite problematic and perpetuating racial stereotypes.
Yeah.
And I wrote a note in all caps. But I was in the hospital giving birth on the day of deliberations. I missed it.
And work-life balance.
Work-life balance. I had to give birth to my baby.
Is important.
That is the most important thing. But unfortunately, I feel like if I had been there, I could have made a much stronger plea for do not let this film in, blah, 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 blah. But The Sleeping Negro did get in, which is great. I mean, it's just you win some, you lose some. I think the whole experience of programming feels very compromised. Mm. And if you're happy to, you know, kill your darlings, whatever it is, you're happy with that at the end of the day, then try it out. It can be fun. You get to discover new talent with that. That's the most amazing thing.
Yeah.
The last year that I programmed, I helped program Actual People by Kit Zahar, whose films have recently been showcased on Mubi a lot.
Okay.
Shout out Mubi. But she's great. Like, she's like a really incredible, really young filmmaker. And so those are the moments where you're like, oh, wow, you know, I've helped to discover someone who is amazing and whose voice and whose films should be seen. But you have to be willing to, fight, argue with people for hours on end, try to, I don't know, help folks understand the kind of racial dynamics, the racial politics, the politics of representation, just even the basic politics of representation.
Their own biases. Like, let's consider where you're coming from when watching this film.
But nobody, you know, the thing with films is filmmaking and cinephilia is that everyone feels like an expert on films because we all love films. Our attachment makes us feel that we are authoritative people about the subject. And so to get people to decathect from their tastes is really so challenging, you know. And I tried everything. I tried like scholarly conversations. I tried like tactics I use in the classroom to mediate. But at the end of the day, people just really love what they love and they don't want to examine their pleasures or their desires, and they don't want you being a killjoy.
Yeah.
You know what Sarah Ahmed calls a feminist killjoy. You being the feminist killjoy in the room means having people confront their pleasures and understanding that those pleasures can sometimes be really harmful or problematic to other people, and that it's not worth it.
Yeah.
And I will say, you know, to the credit of some of those programmers as well, there was a really contested film one year made by a very hipster actor who had appeared in like very cool hipster indie films in Hollywood, and he made a film that was trying to explore kind of like trans identity, which is interesting, but the way that he did it was just, at the end of the day, it left a really bad taste in your mouth, where it was, he was sort of like lampooning transness or playing with that identity in a way that at the end of the day, it just didn't feel, ultimately, you know, you get this affective feeling from films, it just didn't, it wasn't genuine. It wasn't like the sincere exploration. It was taking that identity and using it to,
a tool in some way.
It was cynical, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a cynical use of something that, or appropriation of an identity that didn't feel right. So, so to the credit of Slamdance, there was very intense arguments about that particular film, and in the end, it did not make it in. Mm-hmm. But there were very passionate programmers who fought, you know, to the bitter end that this must make it in, right? Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of emotional labor.
It's a lot of emotional labor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Let's just say, Mila, we appreciate the emotional labor that you're putting into the festivals that you're a juror on, because I am 110% sure that you make their programming and their selections better.
I can imagine it would also be very rewarding being able to have that voice and stand up for the films that you're like, no, this actually needs to be shown, or this filmmaker mm-hmm. needs an opportunity to be showcased.
Yeah.
So sorry to break the conversation. Let's just take a brief little break, and then we'll come back and talk about some production aspects. But stay with us. We will be right back.
Your power. CITR is currently accepting applications for Power in Voice, our new podcast incubation program. Power in Voice is an entry-level, paid educational program that will guide you through every step in the creation of a spoken word audio documentary on a story you want to tell. All may apply. No past experience is required, and all necessary training and support will be provided by CITR and guest facilitators. CITR strongly encourages storytellers with marginalized lived experiences to apply. Please visit www.citr.ca/powerinvoice or contact us at programming@citr.ca. The deadline to apply is October 9th, 2024.
What a lovely Vancouver summer night. I can't wait to sit by myself at the beach and look at my phone. Huh? What's that?
Man, what are you doing? Get over here and come jam.
Wow, what a lovely assortment of musicians. What are you guys doing?
This is E-Studio. We come together and build connections over music. No musical experience needed. Just come socialize and build your confidence playing music if that's your thing.
Wow, this is so awesome. Now I have a real-life connections with Vancouver's international community of musicians and creatives. Thank you, E-Studio. E-Studio is an international jam group where we celebrate music from all around the world and play together. Follow us on Instagram at estudio.cafe. estudio.cafe.
Welcome back. You're listening to Film Picnic on CITR 101.9 FM. We're here with Mila Zuo today. We're talking films. We're talking festivals. Would we like to transition to talk about production a little bit? Let's do that.
I know you mentioned this earlier in an episode, I was going to say that a little birdie told us that you are working on a new project at the moment. And I was wondering if you could/want to share anything about that.
Sure, I'd love to. It's an experimental documentary visual essay. I don't quite know how to describe it yet, but it is a film that's going to be centered on my parents' experiences during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. Both sides of my family were regarded as dissidents of the government when the Communist Party took over. So my paternal grandfather was part of the nationalist government. He was he was working as a policeman for the nationalist government. He was taken to a hard labor camp to be rehabilitated, where he was basically worked to death. He died of pneumonia when my dad was 5, and my dad's family was blacklisted for they were considered this kind of untouchable family. At the same time, my mom was, her father was also, had a position, in the nationalist government, and my mom and her siblings were sent down, what's called sent down mm-hmm. to the countryside to be rehabilitated. So she was rehabilitated for 5 years in the countryside before she was allowed to come back home. And yeah, the film is really thinking about, that particular historical trauma and whether or not we can think about inherited trauma or intergenerational trauma. Mm-hmm. So it's also me thinking about myself and what I sort of might carry from you know, being the child of people who were persecuted during this moment, and and immigrating to and immigrating to the U.S. And if there is our particular experiences or moments from the early days when we immigrated that we could go back and reflect on, you know, the trauma of immigration, perhaps in some ways.
Wow. So is this a documentary film that you mentioned, or is there narrative components in it as well, or documentary?
It's the first part is documentary. So we've already shot a lot of those interviews with my parents over this past summer. And I was able to take two of my graduate research assistants, which was so wonderful.
That's so nice.
It's just the best team of folks working on this project. And then the second part of it, though, is narrative reenactment. So it's going to be there's a kind of genre of documentary that we could call the reenactment documentary. You can think of Joshua Oppenheimer's The Act of Killing is maybe the most well-known. Where he's asking like perpetrators to reenact their crimes. Rithi Pan, who's a Cambodian filmmaker, has also done some reenactments in his films as well about the Cambodian genocide. And so, so actually for this particular film, Mongoloids, we're going to be asking my parents to reenact some of their memories.
Wow.
I will also be, this is a plan. It's a bit fluid at this point. The second part of this shoot is that I'll also be acting as my mom with my mom.
So special.
Directing me.
Aww.
So it gets very good meta.
Yeah.
And thinking about like, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Right. It's we're keeping it all in the family. You know, my little one, my little girl might be playing me.
Oh my goodness. She's so sweet.
She's the age. She is very sweet. Aww. And a good and a great little actor, I think.
Aww.
We had her do some reenactment scenes as me this past summer. We revisited my first daycare, the first place where we landed in Carbondale, Illinois. So we had her run around in this room and just play with these old toys. And
what a special experience to
share. Yeah.
Wow.
Hopefully it'll be healing or reparative in some way, right? Not to be too kind of utopic about the project, but it's about trauma, but also like through ritual and performance, can we begin to sort of heal?
Even just having those conversations with your parents and being able to unpack and like consider with them, how has this affected you? How has this affected us?
Yeah.
I can imagine would be very special.
Yes, I love how you just framed it, considering with. Yeah, it's definitely because it's not all smooth. I mean, we had a huge argument, which luckily we were able to film. I think a part of me wonders if I provocated this argument at the dinner table so that I could have it in the film. But, you know, and probably unconsciously I did. But so there are some really difficult or challenging moments too when working with your family and trying to have them think about their, you know, anger and these responses, these kind of the reactiveness that might have been born out of some historical trauma.
Do you have any idea when you're hoping to have that finished, or is it kind of an ongoing process at this stage?
I'm hoping to we're applying for more grants and fellowships to just take us through the whole project as a feature. So we are hoping to shoot. I might be going to China to accompany my parents. They're going to be interring my grandfather's ashes. He passed away last year. And we then, I'm thinking about doing the reenactment sequences next summer, next fall. But it really depends on a couple different living pieces. It
takes a long time, especially with documentary. It's years.
It's really like a durational project in the way that narrative it doesn't have to be or isn't quite often.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Thank you so much for sharing with us. Sadly, we're coming to the end of our time. I wish we had more time.
I know, there's so many more questions.
I know, we had so many questions to ask, but, you know, we just thank you so much for being here.
And I'm so grateful. Thank you for being our first guest.
Thank you for being our first guest.
I'm beyond honored and delighted. And yeah, this has been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Of course. We do have...
We have a little something for you if you just want to open this basket. The same little birdie.
The same little birdie.
Told us what your favorite movie snack is.
So thank you. Dark chocolate. Yeah.
For those of you that can't see the video right now, audio listeners, we have a little picnic basket with us here in the studio. And what's in that basket? The segment. We just like to provide a little treat. So for your next movie experience, you have a little snack now.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. I will enjoy it.
Mila Zuo, thank you so much
for being here with us today.
Georgia.
Listeners, please enjoy the rest of your day. And don't forget to check us out on FLM at FLM Picnic on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Or you can find the recordings of our episodes at CITR on their website or on Spotify at Film Picnic.
Yeah. We'll see you next week on Film Picnic as we continue debunking the film industry with meaningful conversation.
One picnic at a time.